historically people have dishonoured letters of credit, and once one bank does that to another bank, they just close them out. And they had the wisdom in Bahrain that any time that they owed money to somebody, they always paid it and always honoured the paperwork. So they managed to build themselves a reputation with Western banks on that basis at the commercial level. But there is, no need for that any longer. But from the business plans that I've seen from the financial authority out there, they're fighting aggressively to make sure that nobody else becomes the new financial center for the Middle East, especially Dubai. They're very concerned about the growth of Dubai.
Sure, and Donald, the influence of the World Bank on third world countries, keeping them in bondage with the so-called structural adjustment programs, what's the impact of that?
Well, that's the now. You have to understand the World Bank and the IMF, and someone brought this up in a previous show. Economic hitmen. What they do is they target countries, just like we talked about in the melon example that Mohammed just gave, where they actually go out and they finance an aggressive program at destroying local producers so that foreign producers can come in with their products. Or what they've been very successful at doing is lending governments large sums of money for public works projects at interest, and then having that public works project either not be completed, or if it is completed, becoming so over budget or so expensive that every other resource in that country has to be earmarked to pay off the debt for it. So basically what they've done is they've forced interest payments from countries around the world that can barely support a postal service or whatever, paying for a dam that never went into operation, or paying for a roadway that nobody can drive on. These kinds of things have happened at the hands of the World Bank and IMF, and that's just one of hundreds of horrible things that these people have done. And if you look behind who profited during the actions, you'll find the same all the usual suspects in each instance. But what's your take on it, Mohammed?
Absolutely. There was a very cynical plan from the outset, which involved lending to countries that they knew would never be able to pay back. And there's two bases for that statement. One is, if there was a corrupt leader there, that was helpful. That, they lend them $7 billion, the guy runs off with $5 billion and puts it in a bank account somewhere in the world. Of course, they don't care because they get to go after the assets of the country. In fact, it may be argued that they wouldn't have lent the money had the guy not intended to run off with it, because they wanted those assets quite badly. And they found somebody that they said, look, you can have $5 billion or a bullet in the back of the head. Which would you prefer? That's one basis. Where they've done the slower lending, we have to look at the understanding of dollars. A loan is made in dollars, say for $1 billion, and the country now has to pay back $1 billion. Of course, the problem is that the country doesn't produce dollars as its own domestic currency. Say it has the ringgit, as per Malaysia. This was the example and the information that I gave to Mahathir Mohamed at the time that opened his eyes to what was going on. We have a situation where he borrows $1 billion. He now has to pay back $1 billion. The lender will not accept payment in ringgits, and because he borrowed at 10%, he has to pay back $1.1 billion. Where does he get the $100 million from? He doesn't have it in his economy because he borrowed the billion. Therefore, he has to sell things in his country for dollars in order to pay the extra $100 million that he owed. And this is the game which has been played on everybody. And what would usually happen is that the country wouldn't understand the game that was being played, so we can't afford this. And they'd say, oh, don't worry, we'll lend you another billion and another $100 million so that you can service the debt as well. And they keep playing this game. It compounds up a few years, and before you know it, they're owing $1.5 billion, and they've only got $1 billion, and they say, we'll write it off if you he was titled to these gold mines or these diamond mines or this incredible water resource or whatever it is they've always had their eye on.
That's right, and they're doing it now. I brought up the in the last show the Aurelian debacle in Ecuador, and you know there's big majors with ties to this crime network that got their eye on that asset, which has like 20 or 30 million ounces of gold in the ground, and of course you can't have a resource of that size without having every crook in the world that has always been a traditional crook wanting a piece of that pie, but. Mohammed, you know, we've got a call from, I think it's Ahmed. Ahmed, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing, Daryl?
Good. You got a question from Mohammed.
Mohammed.
Well,
can you hear me?
Yes,
I can.
Essentially, I just had, you know, a comment and a question. I actually just discovered your site, I don't know, maybe couple months ago, and you know I've been glued to it, you know, since listened to all the lectures that, you know, all the interviews that, you know, Mohammed and you know David Pidcock had and your interviews and all your stuff, totally fascinating. I mean, I can't really turn on the TV now anymore except to consider that it looks like just a huge circus. I even turn on some of the documentary shows and I'm like, oh my God! They've even lied about the facts on documentaries, but that's neither here nor there. Just wanted to say, keep up the good work, and Mohammed, look forward to anything more that you can contribute, as well as David Pidcock. One thing I wanted to say is, you know, as far as, you know, obviously as Muslims, we know that you know we've kind of been sold on this whole idea that there's no other method other than, you know, interest banking and interest financing, and you know that's kind of like a illogical, you know, argument if you're a true Muslim, because God forbid that, and God wouldn't forbid your only way of livelihood. But the question is, it's not really clear for Muslims what alternatives there are. A, because there are so few Muslims that are educated on this, and B, the ones that are maybe are kind of, I guess, you know, you could say co-opted or something like that. What should, I mean, you know, I guess maybe this is a question for economists or training economists or bankers, but what do you see the way forward as far as, you know, training people who actually believe that interest shouldn't be, you know, permitted? And the second, you know, it appears that, you know, ultimately there's always a war that's engineered, and then, you know, you get the right kind of people placed in who legislate this kind of stuff anyway. So it, to me, it seems that ultimately it'll just sort of end up in war, or you have to be a country like China that's strong enough to say, well, we're just going to close our doors, and, you know, we don't care how many millions of people we're going to throw at this, you're not going to rule us. So to me, it always looks like no matter what, it'll always come to fists, you know. And
you got a way around this interest system for the rank and file public, instead of going out and getting an 18% credit card, Mohammed. What do you say to a new car loan, or how can we do this and stay within the constructs of your faith?
In a way, that there's the Islamic, I guess, the kind of the Islamic model of where banks have shared risk, shared opportunity, so they're almost like interest-free venture capitalists. Is this a model that could work?
There are several approaches out there which are acceptable from an Islamic perspective at the personal level. One of the things that, if you look at what you were saying there, Ahmed, is you were asking at the personal level and at the social level, etc. At the social level is where things, you're saying, will come to fists, obviously, and not at the personal level. At the personal level, Muslims have a personal responsibility to make sure they're living according to the teachings of their faith. They have to say, you know, am I doing a good enough job here? In respect of what the obligations are upon me and what my duties are as a Muslim. And therefore, that should send them off looking. I have found in both institutions that call themselves Islamic, and even some that don't, for instance the Bank of Scotland, products offered for various types of personal finance which are acceptable from an Islamic perspective. Historically, we used to have in the UK building society. A building society was a very interesting institution in its origin, in that what would happen is that a group of people, not like the Halifax Bank, it was originally Halifax Building Society in Halifax, the people of Halifax wanted to build houses for their future generations about 250 years ago. And so what they did was they got a communal pot of money, they all put money into the pot, and every week or month or whatever they were being paid, and then they would draw lots once a month, and whoever won, whoever's name came out of the hat, that person got the money from the pot to buy land and build a house. And they actually built their homes for the build cost. You bought your house for the build cost, no builders making profit margins or anything like that in it. And it was all an interest-free system. And it was alive and running in this country up until the time of Big Bang, when Margaret Thatcher changed it all. So as recently as 1984-85, these models were still running very happily in the UK, and she went out there and destroyed them on behalf of the usual suspects who didn't want people being empowered on an individual level. At the national level, one of the ways in which I converted to Islam, that I actually came into contact with Muslims before I was a Muslim, on the issue of interest-free banking and economics and finance, I used to be a member of the Green Party in the UK. I was an environmentalist, an environmental activist and campaigner, and a member of the Green Party, and I worked on the Green Party's economic policy. So if the Green Party ever came into power in the UK, they would implement green economics, which are in fact interest-free economics. So there are people who are not Muslim who understand the benefits. We look at the destruction in the world of tropical rainforests servicing the interest on these debts, and just on that alone, somebody lends money to Borneo, $1 billion again, they have to chop down $100 million worth of trees just to get dollars to pay the debt. If we made it interest free, that would be $100 million worth of trees not chopped down. So the environmentalists are tuned into this across the whole of Europe, I'm pleased to say. But it is important, and this is the crux of the matter now. Why don't Muslims have this? Well, the answer is that there are mischievous elements within the community putting themselves forward as scholars who legalized the prohibited. And they said, oh, well, you know, there isn't an alternative, so we have to live with what's already there. And this goes against a very famous old English saying, which is that necessity is the mother of invention. As soon as those scholars legalized not having to do anything, we lost the necessity, which in turn caused us not to invent. And as soon as we get that imperative back as a Muslim community that says, no, we are not allowed to do this, therefore we must find the alternative, it will give us the imperative to produce that alternative again.
I agree with all of that. Bashida, you are with me. Bashida, are you here?
Assalamu alaikum, Mohammed.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And good evening, Daryl.
Good evening.
I would like to know, how long will it take for these banking institutions to collapse? And the real halal way of using money is solid gold, something like that. I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks for your question. This is probably going to be the last question of our evening here, Mohammed. Well, Rashida, let me tell you, first of all, there are going to be, there are already over 117 institutions across the United States failing now. They're in absolute dire straits. There's no solution for them short of huge cash infusions. I see nothing in their future except failure. But that, to me, is only the tip of the iceberg. We've got banking institutions across Europe and the Orient that are going to go belly up as well. And where this is going to end, I can only predict. I only predict Muhammad, because how bad this could get means every company could go down, every bank could go down. Who knows? As far as the other question, I'll let you handle that.
Well, just adding on to what you said there, Darrell, that list of 117, of course, is known as the distressed banks list.
Yeah.
Those are banks that are not only insolvent, but they're distressed in what they've said is, we can't see a way of becoming solvent again, which
That's
means
right.
that they're half a step closer again to bankruptcy.
That's right. They're not Chapter 13, they're Chapter 7, and Chapter 7 is a forced bankruptcy.
That's right, but they've moved that step closer, and when
yep.
we think that you and I, Darrell, we've been watching the progress of the intervention of the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England and the Central Bank of Europe, we've been watching these interventions which have been propping these institutions up, and this is one of the reasons why it's difficult to give a precise timescale. If, for instance, there's no intervention in the bond market in this quarter, that distressed list will go down because they've got to change from being distressed to bankrupt. There's going to be winding up orders, sir.
Yeah, but there'll be no entrance right after that, though.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, the second question was, do you remember?
The second question was gold. And can gold be used as a form of money? Certainly gold. Darrell, you yourself have pointed out that the interesting one there for monetary purposes as a medium of exchange is probably preferable is silver. If people
yes.
were to buy silver coins, then a lot of goods and services can be exchanged for silver. I still do like gold and platinum because you could swap a few gold coins for a horse and a couple of dozen of them for a car, so you can make bigger purchases with them, and again you're free from the banking system.
That's right, and in fact I anticipate gold reaching levels people can't even imagine, $5,000-$8,000 an ounce in the coming years. Well, Muhammad, we've reached the end of our talk here. It was great to have you on once again to talk about these issues. You know, I want to make my attempt into informing the world a non-religious issue, because I believe people from all walks of life need to know about this. There are people in the Hindu community, in the Christian community, people who don't follow religion closely, that have good hearts and that want to know these facts. These are things that we need to bring communities from disparate communities together in fellowship against these forces that have criminalized our planet. And the best way I know how to do that is to be honest and to tell the story as best I can. Do you have anything you might add to that?
Well, of course, Jesus said, "The truth shall set you free." And there are a great deal of number of people out there, I'm afraid, Darrell, that don't want to understand the truth. But one of the things about the truth, whether you're Muslim, Christian, Hindu, atheist, it doesn't make any difference. The reality of that saying is, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. The reality of that saying is, once you have studied the facts of what's going on in the world, rather like the Ahmed who came on and said, "I can't look at TV the same anymore. I can't look at the papers anymore, even documentaries. I realize now this is all propaganda and fraud." Listen, Darrell, these Zionist criminals have colonized people's minds.
Yes.
And through studying this, no matter what your beliefs are, you will free your mind and become a free person mentally, and at least then have the capability to act.
That's right. You're exactly right. And this is the clarity that I'm hoping to engender in listeners, and I want them to be strong in understanding that they should not go out into their world in opposition to other groups of people, but rather go out in a sense of brotherhood, that we're all facing these same forces together, and together we can defeat these forces. But I'll tell you, as long as they keep us factional and keep us fighting one another, we're never going to get the traction we need to defeat them. So we have to put our personal belief system that has been inculcated in us aside, and begin to see this wider world as the world that can take back from these crooks all of the things they've stolen from us. Now, it's a monumental, it's a mammoth job, Muhammad. How I got in at the tip of the spear, I have no idea, my friend. But it's a pleasure to do the fighting with you. And do you have any parting statement for the listeners?
Just as you say, Darrell, for them to be strong, and I would remind them as Muslims to go and look up at their duties and realize that it's more important for them to fulfill their duties, because in doing that, they will actually be automatically part of this fight.
Well, that is, we've got Ramadan coming up, and I want to thank everybody and remind them that the French Connection will be broadcast during Ramadan on Saturday afternoons. We will be going live Saturday afternoons. I don't know the exact time, but check your listings on CII for that broadcast. And, Muhammad, I wish you a wonderful Ramadan and the listeners. And until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, take care of your families. This is the most important thing you can do, because from a healthy family, so many other things are possible. And until the next time, please be well. Bye-bye now.